I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we're getting a global perspective on the secrets of successful cities and a look at the truth about green jobs in America. Christopher Choa is an architect and urban designer and a principal at the design firm EDAL. Chris joins us from London to talk about the design of a successful city and what we can learn from the construction boom happening in cities in the Middle East. And we'll speak with Joan Fitzgerald. Joan is the director of the Law, Policy, and Society program at Northeastern University in Boston. She studied how U.S. and Western European cities are addressing the interrelated issues of global warming, energy independence, and opportunities for green economic development. All that, plus the latest from Walker Smith and Nate Berg. Stick around for Smart City right after the news. And a special welcome to our podcast listeners. You've heard us talk about our social networking site, My City, and the community there has been booming. Hundreds of listeners, just like you, have joined the site and are talking and collaborating on all the issues that mean the most to people who love cities. Want to join? Send us an email to our producer, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com, and he'll get you signed up. I look forward to seeing you online. And now, back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My first guest, Christopher Choa, is a true citizen of the world. Through his work with the design firm EDAW, he has overseen design projects worldwide, from St. Petersburg to Shanghai. His global perspective gives him insight into what makes a successful city today and what a successful city will look like in the future. Chris, what makes cities successful?
Cities are really a combination of a number of things. It's really human capital, the economy in the place, it's the regional context. But really there are six things that make a city really possible. Density, mixed use, the integration of mass transit, the relationship to open space and to hinterland, which is really the natural resources that everyone in the city requires. There's a strong emphasis on delivery, which is really the way in which a city gets built out over time, over generations, or over even a very short period of time. And then fundamentally, it's sustainability. It's the creation of long-term value, socioeconomic equity, environmental resources that really make a city thrive in the long term.
Chris, the first thing on your list was density. How do you deliver density?
Well, density is what cities do best when they're left to their own devices. Humans are a deeply collaborative and social creature, and they naturally tend to be attracted to each other. The big secret of cities is that people are not attracted to buildings, they're not attracted to open space, they're not attracted to nice shops or beautiful landscape. People are fundamentally attracted to people. If you look at all the great settlements, all the great cities in the world, the one thing they have in common is a relatively high urban density. You can take Manhattan, one of my very favorites, with residential densities over 200 residents per hectare. But even places like Paris, quite dense. London, not as dense as New York or Paris, but still relatively dense. All the pre-industrial cities, the great ones, Florence, all the big European cities, are all very, very dense. And simply, that's a function of people needing to be close to each other for their daily needs and their daily life.
But then how do we deliver density in a way that people today, with choices about where to live, will accept it? You know this. People, particularly in the U.S., push back. They think about density as being high-rise public housing projects or people living like ants on top of one another. And the dream of the good life involves space and greenery and a front yard and a backyard. And so how do you marry the dream to density?
Well, it's a very interesting question. The real issue is what people really want and what they're willing to trade off to get it. Certainly in America, there's still very, very much a frontier spirit, an idea that unlimited openness is actually desirable. But what we're finding, particularly in modern life, is that kind of openness and that kind of prospect comes with certain consequences. One of the consequences is isolation. If you have to drive every day for the most daily necessities, it is somewhat alienating. If you have to drive to your neighbor, if you have to drive to your school, if you have to drive to your friends over long distances, it may be a good recipe for an isolated home, but it's not a very good recipe for a society or a very strong communal culture. If you give people the choice of being able to walk to virtually everything that they need to do in the course of a day, or having to drive, or maybe not even have access to things over the course of the day, many people, a great majority of people, will choose the convenience of density. This is not surprising. This is why young people leave rural areas and suburban areas to move to cities. No one's compelling them to move. They're choosing to move. For the first time in the planet's history, very few years ago, we tipped into having a majority of the world's population living in cities. No one is driving them to the cities. This is a choice that the population is making for itself. There are clearly some benefits for that kind of density, and people will choose it for themselves if they're given an attractive opportunity to do so.
You work throughout the world. What do you need to know to work intelligently in a new community unfamiliar to you?
Working in a new community that's unfamiliar to a master planner is really the greatest challenge, because you cannot simply come with preconceptions about what the ideal urban quality will be like without really knowing firsthand what that might be. The interesting thing is that in many cases you're brought to the city, you're brought to the challenge by governments, by developers who are specifically seeking an outside quality. I remember in my early days when I was working in China, I was very, very interested in finding Chinese solutions to urban situations, but I was actually being hired to provide Western ones. And that's often very ironic and difficult to deal with, but it's something that we all have to reconcile. I think the main thing is to spend time looking at the place, extrapolating from other cities that you know very, very well, but also understanding what some of the fundamental differences are that are in common with other places. So, for example, communities in China or in the Middle East may look very different from each other, but they have very similar ideas about the difference between what's public and what's private. And that leads you, in turn, to think back on solutions that you've had in the past that have those differences as well.
What are the big trends in urban design today? What problems are clients asking you to solve?
Well, the problems that clients are asking us to solve, to a certain extent, are very much part of the context that they're in. In Europe, in England, for example, the biggest emphasis right now is on the regeneration of post-industrial cities. Industrial towns that used to be very, very big with a single industry and now are really struggling, whether they were in foundry locations or mining or textiles, and now they found the industrial base disappeared, but they're really struggling to keep together. Our struggle there is, of course, trying to find new regional positionings, branding, combination of uses and density that really will help them attract outside investment and generate growth. That's the challenge for Europe. I think in the case of places in the Gulf, other parts of Southeast Asia or China that are experiencing really rapid growth, the issue there is to try to find a way to accommodate the very, very rapid growth while still allowing a great deal of flexibility, because the incoming populations are coming from very, very different backgrounds economically, sometimes even socially, and there needs to be a very flexible network to accommodate all that. Probably the biggest issue that is starting to be very strongly felt for everyone are issues around sustainability. How can you keep resiliency if there are climate change issues that cause development pressure, or if the price of energy fluctuates a great deal? And for that, I think density becomes important, but also the integration of mass transit.
You and I met recently in Abu Dhabi at the Global Cities Forum, and you work extensively there. I was impressed by Abu Dhabi's plans to move toward a sustainable development pattern. But, Chris, can they get there with their current car dependence, which seems extreme?
The issue of sustainability and big development in the Gulf has always been a strongly illuminated topic. There's no question that the region represents an enormous amount of excess by many, many statistical measures. It's a small area, but has one of the highest per capita consumption rates in the world. It has a carbon footprint that's probably three times as heavy as North America, which in itself is a very, very heavy place. It has enormous energy needs, mostly because of transit and cooling, for example, in the summer, but also because virtually all of their potable water has to be manufactured with great consumptions of electricity. So these are definitely negatives. On the other hand, it's one of the very few places in the world that has the cash, basically paid for by oil sales, that can fund the development of infrastructure before there's really a demand for it. Now, in some cases, you see this manifested in the fact that they can build enormous airports long before they have even established the need for vertically integrated transport hubs. But it also means that places like Abu Dhabi can fund enormous amounts of research and development in sustainable energy. So there's the Masdar initiative, which was recently funded by the state, which will pay down research, develop cooperative enterprises between companies that are engaged in sustainable design, will actually pay for the technology to provide renewable energy in the Gulf. To a certain extent, these are demonstrator projects. You can argue that they're not really required economically. But the irony is that places like Abu Dhabi and other places in the Gulf may in fact have more sustainable technology in place sooner than virtually any other country anywhere else in the world. And they will become energy leaders one way or another.
So if not oil and gas, then in sustainable technologies or renewable technologies?
Yeah, very much so. One possibility comes to mind, and that's solar thermal, electrical energy that's generated by the sun, but not through photovoltaics, which really converts sunlight directly into electricity, but that creates a very, very high pressure, high temperature steam, which in turn powers a turbine, which in turn creates electricity. What you need is lots of space and lots of sunlight, and those are two things that right now the Gulf has in abundance. And on top of that, you need lots of money to pay down the infrastructure in the first place, and that's also something that's readily available. So you can see why, in a very positive way, there's perhaps a perfect storm, at least from a sustainability point of view, that allows the convergence of all these technologies.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Choa of the design firm EDAW. We're talking about the booming economies in the Middle East and how cities like Abu Dhabi are leading the way in sustainable development. I asked Chris whether the governments of Middle Eastern countries think they've reached peak oil.
At some point, all of these economies are facing the prospect of peak oil. There's no question about that. The only question is when. Some people feel like we are nearing peak oil right now. Some people feel that it's going to be around 2020 or 2030. That's basically the range, and there's no question that that's going to happen one way or another. All of the cultures in the Gulf in particular, and frankly, any economy that's heavily dependent on oil revenues, are thinking what they will do in the near term to take advantage of the last generation of oil revenues and really invest in things that create long-term value for their societies and for their economies. Peak oil is coming. The question is, what do you do with what you have right now?
U.S. cities, of course, don't enjoy those oil revenues for the most part. How do they compete? How do U.S. cities compete with cities and nations that have this kind of money at their disposal to build infrastructure, as you say, before it's needed, long before it's needed, and also make the research and development investments?
Well, U.S. cities seem at first to be at a great disadvantage to some of the regions in the Gulf, but U.S. cities and the U.S. economy as a whole has a great advantage, and that's simply size. We read all the time about Dubai. The population of Dubai is 1.5 million people, and even if it were to grow at a very strong rate by 2020, it would barely reach 3.5 million people. All of the Emirate of Abu Dhabi is under 3 million people. So these are really very, very small nation states, and economically the U.S. has a great advantage because it has the critical mass of density, which in turn creates all sorts of opportunities socially and economically. America has, through its educational programs, a huge educational and training advantage over a lot of the states in the Gulf. The Gulf doesn't have a very highly educated group at the very highest levels. It is struggling very, very much to create educational resources for themselves. And they look often to American training, American teaching, American technology, and American innovation to help them develop. I think U.S. cities as a whole, if they do in turn invest in their own technology, in their own people, actually have the mobility and the education to provide all sorts of advantages over places in the Gulf. What they struggle to do, of course, is to get the infrastructure together. I think certainly in the next few years, we are going to be facing very strong challenges for infrastructure, just basic things, transport, bridges, roads, the things that are deteriorated a great deal. And newly formed or newly developing emirates are all basically building out that stuff at a very rapid rate for the first time, so it's all fresh. So it'd be like the American expressway system in the 1950s when it first landed on the ground.
From your vantage point, what are the most undervalued or underused assets in cities? What are we not making the most of?
There are a lot of cities which I would say are almost all right. There are places where you have a critical concentration of people, but they are hampered because they don't have the mass transit infrastructure to pull them together. I would say the hidden value is the density that's potentially possible, because that density is what allows everything else to happen. If you have the density, you have the critical mass of people, you have the economy to support high-quality open spaces and commercial and retail and entertainment, when you have the ridership that supports mass transit, which in turn allows a better quality of urban development. You take cities like Detroit, for example, which traditionally had a strong urban core and then gradually expanded outward further and further and further and in enlarging circles out into the suburbs until the core itself became a shell. You have potentially a urban group which is very, very dispersed, which when pulled back together under attractive conditions with similar opportunities for smart growth that a lot of developing parts of the world are having right now, you have potentially the machine for creating a lot of very, very strong sustainable growth that would be very attractive in the long term.
Is density also fundamental? Is that the big move that we have to make to attain sustainability?
That's certainly a very big part of it. Right now, the reason why the of our most attractive capitals worldwide are dense. If you think, Carol, of all the places you would like to visit, if you have a week's holiday, you might want to visit Paris. You might want to visit Rome or London. You go there because of the attraction of the people and of the density and the richness of all the offerings that are there. So density is definitely a big part of it. But fundamentally, what makes those European cities work the way they do is energy pricing. The cost of gasoline in the UK, for example, is around $7 to $8 a gallon. So it's roughly double, more than double what gasoline was at its peak about a year ago. So you could say that density is really what allows all these things to happen, but actually it's relatively high energy prices. Probably the single thing that is in the way of creating smart growth in urban cities, urban centers of the United States, is the cheapness of power, cheapness of energy. It's not that different than what caused a lot of our financial problems now, which was the cheapness of money and the cheapness of available loan capital. So these are two parts of the same issue. Density is definitely the physical manifestation of vitality, but you could also say outside challenges are things that also allow density to happen.
There's been a lot of debate worldwide about the importance of iconic projects. I won't say buildings, but projects. Tell me your view on iconic buildings or projects.
Well, all cities have a face. And just as when you meet somebody in a crowd, you often look for cues to their face. You look for their character. You look about their feelings, their ambitions from their face. I think so, too, people can tell something about a city by looking at not only its skyline, but the character of its open public realm, of its buildings, of its parks. Iconic Building forms are very much a part of that. It's hard to imagine Paris without its landmarks, or Rome or New York or any other great city. We can also think about how landmarks put not only cities, but the idea of potential on the map. Think of Bilbao without its original Guggenheim Museum. No one would have even heard of it, much less imagined the power of culture that's possible when you put something like that on the ground. Places in the Gulf have their own fascination with landmarks. In some places like Dubai, they've even looked at creating signature landforms out in the water or on the shoreline, or extraordinary development on the ground as part of their signature. You can almost see that as gigantic land art as opposed to a building, because that's really maybe something that's possible when you have great expanses that are undeveloped. But I think the issue of landmarks is critically important, and it's definitely part of the makeup of the city.
We talked a bit also when we were together in Abu Dhabi about the role of U.S. cities in a globalizing world. London is probably the dominant world city today, with New York close behind. As a former New Yorker now living in London, what do you predict for those two cities?
London and New York are twinned in so many different ways. They're certainly part of the same family. They share similar ambitions, I think. They're certainly both bicontinental, to the extent that they have Americans living in London and British nationals living in New York. Now, on the other hand, they're very different cities. New York is very, very dense, is very proud of its gritty urban character. Inside every Londoner, on the other hand, is a pastoral dream, a farmer looking to get out and have his own plot of farmland right in the middle of the city. So I think the temperament and the pace of the two cities are different. The future of those two cities is both very, very strong, simply because they are so interested in many of the different things. I would say, on the other hand, and I say this as a New Yorker who desperately loves Manhattan, that in some way I feel that the world has shifted. It is not so American-centric. The center of gravity, the developing world, is definitely to the east. It's the Middle East. It's Central Asia. These are all areas that are much, much closer to cities in Europe, and London in particular. Even China, which is a good distance flight from San Francisco, is still about the same distance, or maybe even a little shorter flying time from London, and certainly much shorter than flying from New York. So geography isn't everything. Geography is not destiny. I think that's really the energy of the people and ambition and aspiration. But location helps, and London is starting to feel the edge that comes from a slightly closer location to a lot of developing areas. Mm-hmm. That corridor from Dubai to Shanghai is really where growth in the world is going to be felt in the next generation or two. And it's interesting to be relatively close to that if you live in London.
Chris, thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
Christopher Choa is a principal at the design firm EDAW. He joined us via Skype from his busy office in London. To find out more about Chris's work, we have a link on our new website, smartcityradio.com. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Demographics are shifting in America. Census estimates put the population of minorities above 50% by mid-century, and one out of every three Americans will be Hispanic by then. These demographic shifts are already playing out in many places, especially the suburbs, where lower housing prices had drawn immigrants in for decades. In the Southern California city of Anaheim, the scales have already tipped. According to U.S. Census figures and a recent article from the Los Angeles Times, the Hispanic population in Anaheim is now more than 50%. Demographers say the shift has two prongs, more Hispanics moving in and more whites moving out. But unlike the immigrant cities of the past, Anaheim is also experiencing much of its growth from natural increase, with more than half of the population U.S. born. Some say Anaheim may be a demographic vision of the future of the American suburb. Meanwhile, in the exurbs of Texas, demographics are shifting in a bad way, mainly out of town. Small East Texas towns like Overton and Dangerfield are struggling with negative population growth, failing industry, and a local economy that can't provide for the needs of its younger populations. According to a recent article from the Longview News Journal, locals estimate that 90% of high school graduates leave town every year. Providing opportunities for younger residents has been a challenge for these small cities for decades. Now with the economy in a recession, things are even worse. Some locals are focusing on infrastructure improvements to lure in new development and business, but some older residents prefer things the way they are. Whether or not these towns should try to change their ways is up in the air, but unless they do, they're likely to keep shrinking until they disappear. And further west, another city is facing its own set of struggles. Not because it can't provide enough, but because it provided too much. Las Vegas was booming just a couple of years ago. Now, business is floundering, home values are a fraction of where they were, and half-built mega projects are being abandoned. Current TV took a recent look at Las Vegas, which was the fastest-growing city in America just a few years ago. The bust has hit people hard. Jobs have dried up, and Las Vegas is now home to one of the highest rates of foreclosure and eviction in the U.S. Pro-growth economics since the 1980s allowed housing to act as a fail-safe investment for people looking to ride the upward market. But in Las Vegas, that fail-safe investment has turned out to be more of a gamble that many in the city have lost. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen. Coming up after the break, we'll get the inside scoop on green jobs. What are they? Where are they? And what can they do for a city? You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. My next guest is Joan Fitzgerald. Joan is the director of the Law, Policy, and Society program at Northeastern University in Boston, and she's written a forthcoming book about green jobs called Emerald Cities, Linking Sustainability and Climate Change. In it, she describes how cities are leading the way toward greener, cleaner, and more sustainable forms of development. Joan, if you believe much of the rhetoric we're hearing, green jobs are going to save us. Do you believe that?
Start out with a tough question, Carol. I wish I could say I believe that. I believe there are going to be a lot of green jobs. I think we're going to be disappointed in the number, and I think this idea that we're going to be able to employ a lot of inner city residents isn't going to happen to the extent that we had hoped, and a lot of it is because of the economy. So what we're going to end up doing is people are laid off or are maybe going to pick up a little work, particularly in the area of efficiency. I'm hopeful, but I just don't think the millions and millions are there because we're not doing it right policy-wise.
What do we need to do it right policy-wise?
If you look at the Green Challenge, the special issue of the American Prospect that I edited in April, if you point to George Sturzenegger's article, he makes the point that the way we're looking at renewable energy, for example, is projects in the ground. How many windmills or wind turbines can we put up? How many solar farms and so forth? But what we're not looking at is the fact that 70 and 75% of the jobs in either of those areas, respectively, are in the production of the product. And much of that production is not taking place in the United States. Yes, we have Gamesa in Pennsylvania, we have Vestas, we have Clipper, and many others throughout the United States. But the majority of the production is taking place elsewhere, and particularly China is growing very fast. So, for example, one of the optimistic signs I point to in my article in that is Austin, Texas, and what they've been trying to do to promote renewable energy. One of the things is they're building a 30 megawatt solar energy farm. Not one single one of those panels is going to be made in the United States. So the value added is not happening here, and we don't have an industrial policy. Similarly, you look at the transportation sector. Jonathan Feldman's article in there talks about, you know, the number of cities that are expanding subways or updating subways, putting in light rail, putting in trolley. All that's gone in the United States now. What we do is the assembly at the end. But we've had this idea in the United States for many years now that manufacturing is old line, and we've let many of the high value-added manufacturing industries go. And without specific policy to support the manufacturing part of that, we're not going to capture it.
What would that policy look like, Joan? What are we doing wrong? How do we do it right?
Well, there's a strong research component to it. So in every place that I've looked, for example, whether it's Austin that hasn't been as successful in attracting the manufacturers or Toledo that has to some extent, there's a strong university research component to it, to acquiring the next generation technologies in solar, thin film, nano solar, and then capturing the production element of that as well. The various programs such as the Renewable Portfolio Standard that we've done on a state-by-state level and varying degrees of strength in that policy, thinking about it as a national policy. But again, that is just a policy for projects in the ground. What Sturzinger recommends in this article is a financing mechanism, and we have to have more financing available, not only for research and development, but for commercialization of the actual products once the technology's been developed.
But wouldn't we still lose the production capacity to a lower cost country?
To some extent. That happens in just about every sector. Let me just use an example of biotech and biomanufacturing, because that's kind of the other hot economic development strategy at the state and local level. In biomanufacturing, when a firm decides to locate in a particular place, it has to get FDA approval. Once it gets that approval, it's not going to move that particular plant. Any biomanufacturing company is going to build a plant in the United States. They're also going to build one in Europe and perhaps in many other countries. That's the corporate strategy, to be close to markets, to be close to research, for a number of reasons, to be a global company. So yes, but what you want are those companies to start here, do the research, then build a manufacturing facility. And the one I showcase in Toledo, for example, is called Zunlight. It was developed by a University of Toledo researcher. They've got their first plant after many years of research, after many years of getting subsidies from the government and elsewhere. And they've got this plant here. They're probably, when they expand, going to expand in other countries, some for cost reasons, some for access to markets. So the idea is you're going to have to keep innovating and keeping on the cutting edge of innovation. And you will lose some, but some will stay and some will expand.
Let's stick with the Toledo example for a minute, because that's one you talk about in your work. The founder of the company that you profile was in a university setting, correct?
Right.
And was it his wife or?
It was his wife, yes.
And so they were in a university setting, and their research was funded by what, the federal government?
There was state money that went into the research center at the University of Toledo, yes. And there was other government money. And more particularly, if you look at the other one that I talk about in their first solar, probably 15 to 20 years of Department of Energy funding, along with state funding and venture capital funding as well. So yes, many, many years of research went into both companies.
How do we know when we're making good investments in research, or do we?
I'm not a scientist to speak to that directly, but I think there's a number of ideas out there that take a while to perfect. And I can't speak, Carol, to the specifics of what in solar or what, but I think you've got these university researchers. Some of the ideas pan out, some do, some don't, and others just take a long time to get to market. Some of them run out of funding before they actually get perfected. I think that's partly what the university research community figures out.
Let's back up still further and ask the question, what are green jobs?
You know, we think of green jobs as new jobs, and some of them will be, but many of the people working in green jobs are already working. And so a green job could be, let me just go through the areas I cover in my book. I do renewable energy, energy efficiency and green building, transportation, and trash. Okay, so if it's renewable energy, you can look at, well, the actual research that goes on into that. That's a green job, researching it. Then you can look at the actual production of the PV or thin film panels. Those are manufacturing jobs. Then there's the design and system installation jobs. And then, of course, there's maintenance. If you're looking at wind technology, it's the same thing. There's jobs in research. There's jobs in production. Apparently, a wind turbine has more than 8,000 parts. So where it gets very tricky is the people, obviously, who work at the plant that are making the wind turbines have green jobs. But what about the supplier firm that maybe 20 days a month is producing parts for gearboxes for a different sector, and then however many days a month is producing parts for the wind industry? Is that manufacturer a green job? It's not easy to tell. So that's renewable energy. If you look at energy efficiency, well, there's all the jobs in retrofitting, putting in insulation, replacing windows. Again, those are jobs in contracting and constructing that already exist. It's just moving people to doing different things. And it, to the extent that we're investing in energy efficiency, they're doing a lot more of it. Another area that I have found very interesting in the research that I'm doing for my book, Emerald Cities, is, again, related to manufacturing. So if you are building green buildings and you require products that are greener than what goes into traditional painting, whether that's low VOC paint, carpet, other kinds of furniture, window systems, all kinds of products. And so can areas that produce traditional building products transform those economies to producing products that are greener? I look at Syracuse, New York, that is doing a lot of research in the area of indoor environmental quality. And these are heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems that are highly efficient or less polluting. Transportation, I already mentioned. Rather than just installing track, could we actually capture some jobs in manufacturing the cars? And then recycling. And this is an area that gets quite interesting because a lot of people advocate for more recycling and point out that recycling creates a lot more jobs in landfilling. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at these jobs, most of them are not very good jobs at all. So I think we have to be careful with this idea that, you know, everything that glistens isn't green. Every green job is not a green job. And we want to be careful that we're promoting jobs that really are well-paying jobs with mm-hmm. benefits.
You've pointed out, too, that every state and every city cannot be a national production and design center of renewable energy. Are some cities better positioned to win this battle for these renewable energy jobs?
Absolutely. And it's not necessarily the cities that are doing the most in terms of, call it sustainability or having a climate action plan. For me, as someone who studies urban economic development, I'm particularly interested in, is it possible for the green economy to help revitalize Rust Belt cities, which is why I started out with this story of Toledo. To me, it was such an encouraging story that here's a city, it's on nobody's list in terms of sustainability or climate change. Partly because, you know, when you've got such a high unemployment rate, frankly, climate change is kind of low on your urban agenda, but yet can develop sustainability around an economic development strategy. Similarly, I focus on Cleveland, that's trying to become a center in offshore wind production. That's very much in process now. It's not clear whether that's going to happen or not. I think Chicago is another good example of a manufacturing town that's really exploring options for renewable energy and other types of technology to employ manufacturing workers. Other cities are positioning themselves through their sustainability plans. One city that I really am very impressed with in this regard is Los Angeles. Los Angeles has some of the most progressive policies in place around climate change, renewable energy, trash disposal, waste management, but they're very much doing the nuts and bolts economic development strategy. So they're looking at land use. They're looking at how to reemploy brownfields. What kind of clean technology parks could they develop? And they're approaching it very comprehensively, and they also have a social justice agenda that they're trying to connect this with jobs for low-wage workers in the city.
How is that being coordinated?
Through their offices of planning and economic development. I think I think the word you used about coordinated is one that's very important. You're seeing many cities now creating new offices of sustainability that may or may not be connected to planning and may or may not, or what we think of land use planning, the traditional planning, may or may not be connected to economic development. Portland is another one that's really started to move on this front. Recently combined the offices of planning and sustainability into one, and then is working very close with their Office of Economic Development to look at ways to think together. I think Chicago is another very good example of that. Sadu Johnson, as Commissioner of the Environment, is working very closely. I think there's been another reorganization, but in what was the Department of Planning and Development, and looking for ways that ideas about sustainability can be linked to an economic development strategy. And that's what my whole Emerald Cities book is about, is how are cities making these links, and what kind of changes do we have to see in the way city government works to make it happen?
I recently walked the floor of a wind power convention, really, that was being held in Chicago at McCormick Place, and I was struck by the number of foreign companies represented at the wind power conference. And certainly there were nations that had gathered up their smaller suppliers and were displaying as a nation those companies. And it certainly strikes me that the U.S. begins behind the starting line when it comes to renewables. Would you say that's the case?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at in the top 10 in both wind and solar, I think in wind there may be one U.S. company, in solar there might be a couple, and it's just astonishing how quickly China is taking over on that list.
Joan, did we get behind because of our lack of investment in research, our lack of federal encouragement, lack of buyer market? What happened?
Well, it was all of the above. If you looked under Reagan, budgets for research in renewable energy were cut dramatically, never really increased. And so even though solar technology got its start here, we quickly lost our position because we weren't doing the research and innovation. The other thing that we weren't doing is creating a stable investment environment. So if you look at Germany, that was offering a feed-in tariff, which is a mechanism that anyone from the person who has a solar system on their rooftop to large-scale solar and wind farms sell back to the utility at a highly subsidized rate that's paid for through the utility bills. But the whole idea of it is to create a stable investment environment, because you're not going to invest in a technology that isn't proven yet unless you know there's a market for it. So it's essentially creating a market. And that's how Germany became such a power in solar and wind technology. It certainly wasn't because of its capacity in either one, in terms of the amount of wind or the amount of sun received in most parts of Germany. We had a federal production tax credit, which rather than being offered long term, was renegotiated in Congress on a yearly or biannual basis, so that there wasn't that kind of investment environment. And so now we want to move ahead on it, and we're behind on the technology, and the markets have pretty much been sown and captured already. It's a very highly concentrated industry in both wind and solar, in terms of, I think the top five wind companies control something like 82% of the market, world market.
Wow. Can cities use their energy purchasing power to encourage development of jobs tied to renewables, or is that horse out of the barn?
To some extent. You know, one example is Berkeley, that's created this new financing mechanism to make it so that residents don't have the upfront costs on putting in solar systems. It's a great idea, but they have no illusions that it's going to use locally produced or even U.S. produced solar parts. So I think some places have just given up on it. I have seen some cities that are trying to use their purchasing power to create markets, but I think most cities don't have that kind of purchasing power. It has to come from, at best, state government, but really it has to be a national commitment.
Are cities that own their own utilities, cities like Austin, in a favored position on renewables and related jobs, in your opinion?
Well, look at Austin. I mean, Austin has not been able to create a production industry despite the fact that it has a locally owned utility. they did everything a city could in terms of how you can do it right. They invested in the research. They created the investment environment. They paid more of a rebate for people installing systems if they were locally produced. They've developed the technology parks, incubators. They've done everything right and haven't been able to do it. And I think there's a real lesson there in terms of being able to succeed. And again, it's the idea that not every place is going to be a winner in this. And why Toledo was able to develop it, as the article lays out, was because it had a glass industry, and essentially a solar panel is a glass product. So it had the technological base in terms of its manufacturing base that, being an IT economy, Austin didn't.
It's so interesting, this notion of sort of mining a community for its skills and its assets, and then updating those, using those to transition to new industries. It's like, what do automakers know how to do? What do auto workers know how to do that is useful to making something else, right? I mean, but we don't often think about that, I think, often because we don't think about worker skills independent of the companies that own them. And so if the company's not able to make the transition, frequently we just assume the workers and the facilities can't make the transition, and that's not always the case.
Absolutely.
Even if there are few green jobs for your community, switching to renewables still has benefit beyond the jobs they create, right?
Absolutely. And that's what you're going to see. There will be places that are making these transitions and, you know, really becoming green cities. We know the winners on this that come up at the top. It's Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, Austin, that are really committed to it, that have had climate action plans for years now, that are moving the city to renewable energy, that have recycling rates. For example, many cities in California, because of state legislation, have recycling rates of 65% and above. And there's reasons to do this, obviously, outside of economic development. My focus has been, how can we connect it in economic development?
Joan, I appreciate so much your talking with us on Smart City. Your new book, Emerald Cities, Linking Sustainability and Climate Change, will be published by Oxford University Press fall of this year. We look forward to seeing it. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
You're welcome, Carol.
Joan Fitzgerald is the author of the forthcoming book, Emerald Cities, Linking Sustainability and Climate Change. We have a link to a site where you can pre-order the book on our new website, smartcityradio.com. Her interview was engineered at Unity Gain Recording. Finally, this week, as we get closer to summer and it starts to warm up outside, our City Views commentator Walker Smith remembers when it wasn't so easy to cool off.
The houses in which I grew up in North and South Carolina had no central air conditioning. Only our bedrooms had window units, and those came down in October when it got cool enough to sleep with the windows open. All summer long, our house was at the mercy of the sun. I guess I just got used to it, though, because to this day I don't like conditioned air. As long as the air is moving, I'm happy with the heat and humidity. I can do without air conditioning. Now, I know this makes me odd, but it's only been within my lifetime that air conditioning has become commonplace in the South. The New York Times called the 1970 census the air-conditioned census because during the 1960s, in-migration topped out-migration in the South for the first time in 100 years. My father jokes that when air conditioning was invented, the South finally won the Civil War. There is a long entry for air conditioning in the Encyclopedia of Southern Culture because the cultural impact of air conditioning has been profound. Some commentators have speculated, only somewhat tongue-in-cheek, that the stories of Faulkner and Williams and Welty and others would have lacked the heat that made them so compelling if these authors hadn't had to literally break a sweat to put their tales down on paper. Air conditioning changed the face of the South, and indeed that of the whole western, southwestern, and southeastern Sun Belt. The cultural and business impact of air conditioning has been enormous. In fact, in idle moments lately, I've been wondering if the ultimate root cause of the current housing crisis isn't really air conditioning. After all, some of the biggest bubble markets in the recent run-up in housing were in the hottest climates all across the Sun Belt. Las Vegas, Phoenix, Atlanta, Charlotte, Fort Myers, Miami, Tampa, San Diego, just to mention a few. Now, I fully realize that air conditioning has nothing to do with the worldwide so-called giant pool of money that went looking for returns, or with unprecedented low interest rates, or with aggressive mortgage brokers, or with high finance mortgage-backed derivatives. But there sure would have been a lot less interest in these hotly priced properties without an air conditioning compressor pumping away in the side yard. Air conditioning made these areas livable for many people and thus made the houses there attractive and desirable. I realize this whole idea is pretty out there, but there is a lot about the modern South that would simply not exist if air conditioning was not available to insulate people from its defining environmental characteristic. If you want to understand what goes on in the Sun Belt these days, you have to factor in air conditioning. It's there in the background, at least, making every other decision or mania possible. Unfortunately, though, I guess all the air conditioning in the Sun Belt wasn't enough to cool down the recent fever over housing. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Each week we tell you how much more smart city there is on our website. Well, this week we're proud to launch the brand new smartcityradio.com. You can see pictures of my travel, check out my Twitter feed and my blog, check out some more information about the show, or join our social networking site, My City. As usual, you can subscribe to our podcast and our newsletter and get in touch. Click on the contact button or send us an email, questions@smartcityradio.com. Special thanks to Adam and Lance at Green Egg and Sheila at CEOs for Cities for all their help getting the website up and running. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. There's a very good reason that his picture is not on our new website. I'm Carol Coletta.